This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Sam King, the longtime sports writer for the Baton Rouge State Times and Morning Advocate. Now retired, but he's written a book covering LSU sports for 35 years, Tiger Beat. We'll talk with him about the passing of Joe Dean, LSU's athletic director for 14 years, 87 to 2001. Died yesterday at the age of 83. And also, Johnny Football, the reigning Heisman Trophy winner, comes to Baton Rouge. LSU hosts Texas A&M Saturday. The Tigers have been installed as four-point favorites. Also, David Huddle, a well-known literary man who will be in Baton Rouge this week. He'll talk about his appearance at LSU. And we'll visit with David Colbert, LSU historian. This is the week that we observe the 50th anniversary of the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Sam King, the longtime sports writer, covered LSU. That's the focus of his book. It's called Tiger Beat, covering LSU sports for 35 years. Sam King, who was a mainstay with the Old State Times and the Baton Rouge Advocate, and covered LSU intricately, the author of two books. Charlie Mack was the first one, and now he's back with Tiger Beat. Good morning, Sam King.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing well, and you're joining us from beautiful Pierre Part. And before we get to the business at hand, this is something that people are buzzing about today, the passing of Joe Dean, who died yesterday at the age of 83. He had a career at LSU that literally spanned 65 years from the day he walked on campus as a freshman in 1948. Until the day he died, he was active with LSU, and he was athletic director for 14 years. You write a bit about him in your book, noting that when he hired Jerry DiNardo, it was in the most unusual of circumstances. You recall that time, don't you?
Yeah, I certainly do. It was everybody was hustling, trying to find out who the new AD would be, and we're watching LSU and Arkansas play in a press box about halftime, and Joe and Herb Vincent walk around. About that time, they flashed the Vanderbilt score on them. And I think it was about 45-0 at halftime. And looked up and they said, "Oh, who's the coach?" And I said, "I don't know. It just sort of better not be this guy there." It turned out it was. Herb and Joe looked awful stunned.
Well, the score was 65-0 in the final then. And DiNardo still got the job after his Vanderbilt team lost to Tennessee. But you remember the first choice, the guy who was actually hired, was Pat Sullivan.
Yeah, it sure was. In fact, right up until midnight on before the paper came out that day, I was in Atlanta covering some event. I guess it was a championship game. And our executive sports editor, Butch Muir, was on the phone with me. They'd got reports and said, "Definitely Sullivan was coming." And I said, "I don't read that. I hadn't found out a word." I said, "We're debating whether to go ahead and go with the story or not." And finally he mentioned, or the guy said, he saw Joe Dean in Dallas about 3 hours ago. And I said, no, I just saw him right here in Atlanta. He's not there." So we fortunately didn't go with the story. We always try to make sure we got it right. And we certainly made a great guess that time.
Well, Pat Sullivan, if people don't remember, was hired to succeed Curly Holman and did not come to LSU after he was hired because he had a buyout clause, and LSU declined to pay the buyout. So the Tigers ended up with Jerry DiNardo for five seasons. He was fired, and then Joe Dean ultimately hired Nick Saban in at the end of 1999. He doesn't get much credit for that, but there's no doubt he found him. He hired him. And as they say, the rest is history. Do you miss the fact that you have not covered LSU in recent times when the Tigers have been so good?
Well, I did do a sidebar in a championship game in the Superdome when they played and won the national championship. But other than that, I hadn't wrote anything. And, yeah, I miss the excitement. I miss the fans and the association with a lot of coaches and some of the players and the writers and that type of stuff. But not enough to go through the regular routine you have to get everything right.
Well, as you page through or go through the pages of Tiger Beat, there are some great photos, and one of them has the staff of the State Times when you shut down the afternoon newspaper here in Baton Rouge. And think about the sports staff, a photo of you and Mike Cook, Sheldon Mickles, Burnell Ballard, Scott Rabelais, Bonner Ridgway, George Morris, Joe Macaluso, and Howard Arsenault. That was quite a staff.
It was a great staff. They all did an outstanding job, and one of the things that everybody did, they worked their hardest they could, and that's all you could ask to do that. And they had some very talented writers then. Joe Mack's still hanging in.
He sure is, and George Morris is still going strong.
Yeah, George is one of the top writers around, I'm sure. And George was with the one of the newspapers in Tampa, an afternoon paper, when it folded. So then when he come to the State Times and it folded, I said, look, I'm not sure we want you as an advocate the way you fold in paper. But George is an excellent writer.
Well, the State Times ultimately folded. Maybe it's George's fault. But But Sam King, you survived 35 years covering LSU sports. You covered a lot of games. And this week we have an unusual scenario with the reigning Heisman Trophy winner, Johnny Manziel of Texas A&M, coming to Tiger Stadium. Surprisingly, LSU is a four-point favorite over A&M, but Johnny Manziel, I'm sure, will fill the stands despite LSU having a somewhat disappointing season.
Well, I tell you what, watching him is a little reminiscent of watching Pistol Pete on the basketball court, because he has some awesome moves and I don't know, you just keep waiting for him to make the wrong step and somebody flatten him, but he still avoids all that major contact. He is a super player.
Yeah, he can run as well as he throws, and he throws pretty well, and he's much bigger than he appears. He's certainly, for example, a much bigger man than Drew Brees of the Saints, who did pretty well yesterday and became the sixth quarterback to pass for 49,000 yards in a career as the Saints beat the 49ers 23-20 at the gun. But Johnny Manziel, I think he'll be a good pro quarterback, and he's quite likely to go pro. Think about LSU and Heisman Trophy winners in the Southeastern Conference. Herschel Walker never played here. Bo Jackson never played at Tiger Stadium. And now there's a chance for LSU to see Manziel. Some compare him to Tim Tebow, but maybe on an excitement level, yes, but they're certainly much different types of quarterbacks.
He is so much more elusive and has, I think, better mechanics on throwing the ball and gets rid of it really quick. He's exceptional, that's for sure. One of my memories, in case you're interested, on Herschel Walker, I used to go cover what they call that Southeastern Conference Athlete of the Year. And they'd have the top players from each school and every sport there and honor them at a banquet that night and all. Well, I was out in the swimming pool with talking with Rodney Gaines from the University of Florida. He was their swimmer athlete of the year. And Herschel come out, and we're all talking in the pool, and Rodney tells him, said, look, come on, let's race to this side, Herschel. And he said, oh, I can't swim, fight. He said, come on, race. And he raised and beat him. He said, I just wanted to go on the record that I beat Herschel Walker at something.
He was a great athlete, and it's a shame that he never played in Tiger Stadium. But Johnny Manziel, barring something really unusual, will be there Saturday afternoon in all his glory, and the way the LSU defense has faltered at times and the Texas A&M defense has been porous, we may have a 60-55 game come Saturday. And speaking of scoring exploits, you noted Pistol Pete Maravich a few comments ago. All these years later, 43 years since he last played at LSU, he still holds the record for career points, and he only played three seasons, no three-point shot either. And an average that will, I'm sure, never be broken, 44.2 points per game. How does a guy do that? How did Pistol Pete do it?
One thing, he could shoot, and he had a very, very good shots, could shoot from virtually any position. But one thing it's always missing, the press getting the credit were setting picks. I mean, he would have picks everywhere to try to spring Pete loose. And so, and of course, once he got loose, he could shoot. And one of the things that was so outstanding, he shot outside so well that he'd pull up at that right side of the key and hit what would be a three-pointer now. And, well, one year LSU was getting rid of a bunch of stuff, and they had the play-by-play of the games. And they would keep in play-by-play, they'd say, Maverick from 23-foot or 18-foot or whatever. So I checked back on about 8 or 10 of the games, and had that been a three-point line, although he didn't know it, he would average like 7 points a game more. And the game he broke the record, individual game, he'd had 12 more.
He scored 69 in his high game at LSU. You're saying he would have had 81?
Yeah, sure would. And that's not knowing the line was there, three-point line.
Well, Sam King will be at LSU this Saturday, 10 o'clock, at the Lod Cook Hotel. And, of course, he'll have his book with him, Tiger Beat. And this is a guy who covered LSU like few or any others for 35 years. You got close to a couple of the coaches, Charlie McClendon, Dale Brown. How are those relationships?
Oh, they were outstanding. And, of course, Dale and I are still friends. We see each other and talk. And he and T.J. Moran, the reason I even wrote the book, we were visiting with them and sitting around shooting the bull, and I was telling them some of these stories and said, "You got to write a book." I said, no, nobody's interested in that. And they kept on, so I did, and kind of looks like people are interested in it, so they're going good. And it's, you know, they got me spurred on, and the only thing I wrote so much on it, I told him it'd be longer than Gone with the Wind. He said, "We'll just call it Full of Wind."
Well, you start out, who said Shaq would never make it as a basketball player?
Oh, his high school coach. He's kind of like Bob Pettit was. Pettit got cut from the team also when he was in high school and played YMCA ball. But Shaq kind of proved them all wrong.
I would say so. Tiger Beat is the book from Sam King, who covered LSU for 35 years. And I noted at the start that Joe Dean was around from 1948 to the present. He left as AD in 2001, but he had quite an impact on LSU sports, and by all rights, the Athletic Administration Building should be named in his honor. He's the one who made it happen. But Joe Dean, he was a famous guy, far more famous than he was as athletic director when he took the job, and he gave up his color announcing, Mr. String Music. He gave that up, Sam. Not many people would forfeit fame for a chance to work at their alma mater.
Boy, not the truth. He enjoyed that, and what he probably enjoyed more than all of it was his basketball camp at Summit, Mississippi. That was one of the first times I really got to talk and know Joe. Dale picked me up in Watson, and we rode up to Summit, Mississippi, to where he had his camp. And he had those kids so motivated and jumping up and down, it was like I don't know what when he told them to hit the court. But he was a great great motivator, and just a super guy at LSU, and obviously knew what he was doing to keep the financial bit flowing while they were having bad years in football.
Yeah, not many people could do that. They had 8 losing seasons in 11 years between 89 and 99, and Joe Dean kept the athletic department in the black and also oversaw the construction of the first suites at Tiger Stadium that have now become a staple, and next year the capacity will be over 101,000. Quick story about Joe is that I was in, and we're going to be talking about the Kennedy assassination this week, but I was in Dallas at Campese's, it's called Campese's Egyptian Restaurant on Mockingbird Lane. This is several years ago. It's actually an Italian place where Jack Ruby had his last meal before he shot Oswald. And there on the wall with all these luminaries was Joe Dean's pictures right between those of Muhammad Ali and Jack Nicklaus. So that shows you how well-known he was in other parts of the country.
Oh, yeah, he sure was. And, Jim, you know, everybody had their imitation of Joe Dean with String Music and go through with Joe announced. And so one year they were having an SEC tournament in Birmingham, and Dale and Joe and several sitting around the room and had the radio on, and they were having a thing going to give prizes for first, second, and third in Jodine imitation kind.
We're going to find out about that in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we resume our conversation for a few more minutes with Sam King. Tiger Beat is the book. He'll be at the Lod Cook Center, actually the Andoni Museum. That's where he will be. I take that back. I've been told it's been moved to the lobby of the Lod Cook Hotel, which is right next door. Saturday, 10 o'clock, Sam King. Sam's book is Tiger Beat, covering LSU sports for 35 years. You were talking about this Jodine impersonation contest, and what happens?
Well, they're talking about it. So I think it was Dale that told him, said, man, you got to call and enter that and see what happens. Well, Joe calls and does his bit with him. Well, he winds up, he finished third. And he said, that shows you what kind of luck I have. I can't even finish third in my own imitation contest.
Can't win his own imitation contest.
Yeah.
Well, Sam, thank you, and congrats on your book, and we'll see you come Saturday.
All right. Everyone come out. We'll talk to you later, Jim. Thanks.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Sam. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears, and this is the week in which we observe the 35th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. John F. Kennedy was killed November 22nd, 1963, in Dallas, Dealey Plaza, Friday. This will be a Friday. We'll talk about it a few times, maybe more than a few this week, and in studio to discuss this and several events that are in accord with the anniversary. Renee Chatelaine from the Manship Theater and Professor David Colbert. Good morning, Professor. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Now, you are a man who goes back and you've studied history since World War II and have written about it prolifically. And when we talk about events in America since World War II, I don't guess there's any event in the 20th century that exceeds the death of John Kennedy. Why are we still buzzing about this 50 years later?
Yeah, I think that anyone of a certain age will say, yes, I remember where I was on November 22nd, 1963. An earlier era, I remember where I was on April 12th, 1945. And for a more current generation, I know what I was doing and where I was on 9/11.
Now, April 12th, 1945 was the day that Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. You were alive then?
Okay. Yes, but were I to tell you I remember it vividly, I would be a goddamn liar.
Oh, well.
I was in diapers.
Well, I was five when Kennedy was killed, and I remember it vividly. And it's hard to believe, but most people alive today were not alive when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated. But 50 years later, people are buzzing about who did it. And also, there is a new discussion, a robust one, about what kind of a president he was in his 1,000 days or so in office. And what's your take on, let's start with that. What kind of a president was JFK?
Well, I think that he benefited from some awfully enthusiastic hagiography right after the time of his assassination. Of course, with an assassination, young president, young kids in the White House, this was such a tragedy that it was hard not to want to speak well of him. But I don't really think that his presidency holds up all that well, unless you are interested in image politics, which interests me. But in terms of substantive accomplishments in his presidency, not really all that much. I remember Russell Long saying that Kennedy had such a poor understanding of the legislative process, how to get a bill through Congress, that he could not get a tax cut through Congress in his presidency.
Well, Ronald Reagan barely got one through, and maybe he shouldn't have in 1981. It was a close vote in the House of Representatives, and he barely got it through with the help of people like Buddy Romer and Billy Tozan, who were Democrats who voted with Reagan. Helped him get his initiatives through. But Kennedy, he had a majority in his own party. But he did have some Southern Democrats who may have been Democrats by name only.
That's absolutely true.
Including Russell Long.
That's true.
Russell Long, who lasted from 1948 to 1987 as a U.S. senator, was there through one of the most tumultuous times in American history, and the scar that was left on the country. Bob Schieffer says America lost its innocence on November 22, 1963. A lot of bad things had happened to America before then, but this was in the televised age. And you got this beautiful first lady, obviously mourning the death of her husband, who's slain right in full view, literally had his head blown off. It was a time like no other.
I would say it was certainly a time of great tragedy, and it helps that there's a good bit of television archival footage extant so that we can go back and take a look at these things. I find myself that the transition in terms of the mechanics of broadcasting makes all of that footage just fascinating. Even the most inane question, the stupidest response, it's really fascinating, whereas I can't say that I spend every waking moment trying to see what's going on with something that's online today.
Well, do you think President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy?
No. And I would say, however, that the Warren Commission report definitely did not allay public skepticism. And I think that we could really say that a culture of disbelief, which is a central part of an oppositional society in America in the 1960s, is related to the inability of the Warren Commission report to actually bring some kind of a closure to this. And there's a recorded telephone conversation that's long been made public between President Johnson and Richard Russell, senator from Georgia, where after the Warren Commission report has been released, right after that, Russell and LBJ are on the phone, and Russell says the commission believes that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connolly. Well, I don't believe it. LBJ, I don't either. That's interesting, the skepticism from the persons that should have been feeling relaxed about this. Russell, having been a member of the Warren Commission, skeptical about its findings.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation. We're hearing right now from LSU historian David Culbert. How many years at LSU?
Since 1492.
Translated what year?
1971.
Okay. So 42 years. You got a 4 and a 2 in there, but not 1492. 1971 was a year that David Culbert came to Louisiana State University. As we know now, he was in diapers in 1945, so you were a young man. You spent most of your life on the campus, and you brought Vincent Bugliosi's book. We've had him on the show. He wrote a voluminous recapping of the Kennedy assassination, despite not using a computer, by the way. Reclaiming History is the book, and we'll talk about that because David is going to be front and center for some events this week, particularly this Friday, the date of the anniversary involving the Manship Theater, and also the West Baton Rouge Museum is collaborating. But David, you think Oswald did it alone. You're convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt.
It's risky to be convinced of anything beyond a shadow of a doubt except death and taxes, but certainly the most persuasive explanation that I have ever found is that Oswald is the lone assassin, and I think that Reclaiming History by Vincent Bugliosi is, in fact, a very good place for someone who might be skeptical about this to take a look, because it really is just enormous. I thought of when the film Parkland, which is going to be shown on Friday at the Manship Center, when they say it's based on Vincent Bugliosi's book, I thought it's a bit like the Norton Shakespeare, which is about the same thickness. If someone said, I'm going to do a film about the British royalty, and it's based on the plays of Shakespeare, whose rights we have purchased. First, you don't have to purchase them, but it's so enormous that you couldn't possibly, you could do 20 books. You might not have a theater full by the time you get through, but you could do 20 films just based on Vincent's book. And it is definitely an acerbic and sometimes kind of over-the-top denunciation of wacko conspiracy theories. He uses wacko himself.
I know he does, and he said it on this show, and I'm not sure he's right, especially when you see Kennedy's head jerk violently backward. You think he was shot from behind?
Well, I'll tell you, the evidence I have, unfortunately, am driven by, because of my line of work, by what I read and what I hear and then what I think.
Not what you see.
I would say that the circumstances of Kennedy's assassination followed by the assassination of Oswald in front of basically large numbers of persons, then followed by the convenient death from cancer of J. Ruby, it the worst kind of really, really threadbare, made-for-television escapist fare wouldn't have a plot that was that creaky. And so I think that anyone who feels that there is a conspiratorial explanation is absolutely entitled to that, but it is also true that the world of what's online allows, indeed, some of the most mysterious explanations to gain
currency. Well, we've got the Zapruder film, and it certainly shows the president's head going violently backward. Now, there have been some explanations for that, but it's kind of like a guy who's caught in an affair, and he says to his wife, "Do you believe me, or do you believe your lying eyes?"
that's a good one, and it's an old one, and I've heard it before. But I bet you've heard everything on the Kennedy conspiracies before, too.
I have, and I've heard a few wackos, too. David on Highland. David, you're on with David Culbert. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. You know, from what I've read, I think Kennedy's claim to greatness would be that at the time there were folks with a Cold War mentality and positions of power, joint chiefs maybe, other who were not averse to a nuclear war if they thought that would defeat the Soviets, and there was considerable pressure from some very powerful quarters to escalate that, and he had enough fortitude not to give in to it, and not every president would have. And, of course, things could have gone another way, and we might not even be here. So I think that's something that he does deserve credit for.
I'd say everyone who's in favor of peace should turn off his radio. No, I absolutely agree with you. The issue would be whether you were to adopt a completely worshipful attitude towards Kennedy and to conflate the fact that he was a telegenic person and sometimes in sound bites showed a genuine wit with the reality of substance. And it's the overall presidency that I think doesn't these days get such high marks from historians.
Here's a question.
I'm not disagreeing with what you just said.
And I'll forward this question in just a moment. I do want to note that Michael Kurtz, the SLU historian, who has an opinion that's much different than that of Professor Culbert, only professor left in America still teaching a course on the Kennedy assassination, by the way. He will be at the press club today at high noon at the Baton Rouge Belle Hotel. So you'll have a chance to hear Dr. Michael Kurtz, who's been on this show many times, today at noon, if you so choose, and it is open to the public. Now, Brian asks, if there was no conspiracy, why are so many documents sealed involving the Kennedy assassination?
A very reasonable question. I think that the Kennedy family, in effect, stuck an oar into a number of issues over fears that there would be tabloid exploitation of things like grisly photos of a head that's been blown apart. But what this did was help fuel conspiratorial belief. And obviously, if you know that there is a document that's significant and are told naughty, naughty, you can't take a look. The logical thing is not to say, oh, trust your government. The logical thing is then somebody's covering up. Somebody's hiding something.
Mm-hmm. Renee Chatelaine with the Manship Theater is with us as well, and remaining time discussing this. We've got some huge activities going on the day of the anniversary. And by the way, Richard Lipsey, who was there for the autopsy of President Kennedy and knew the president as a young soldier, Richard Lipsey will be on this show Friday to talk about his experience. I don't know that he's ever done a radio interview on this topic, but he was there for the autopsy in Washington, D.C. But, Renee, are you old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination?
I'm happy to say on air I was not.
Well, this week, though, as in this Friday, you've got some events, and you're partnering with the West Baton Rouge Museum. What's going on?
Yes. We just felt like, you know, the shared experience of that day, as Dr. Colbert talked about earlier, those of us who were too young to remember Kennedy remember, of course, 9/11, and I think that shared experience lends itself to the events of this week. This we're showing the movie Parkland, which takes really takes only the story of the hospital where, ironically, both President Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald are taken to be treated after the shootings. And we have partnered with West Baton Rouge Parish Museum. They have several events, and if you attend their Friday events, I think they have Leo Honeycutt going to speak at the museum.
Yes. At the precise moment Kennedy was killed, I hear.
Yes, and it also is to celebrate their exhibit, Capturing Camelot. And so if you attend that and come to the Manship Theater, then you get free popcorn and a drink. We're also showing Parkland at 3 p.m., so immediately following that talk with Leo Honeycutt, you can attend the film screening. And then at 7 p.m., we have Dr. Colbert, who will be on hand to speak before the film at 7 p.m. And Mr. Lipsy actually will be one of our esteemed guests. And so if you've attended Capturing Camelot, you get that discount. And then if you bring your ticket later after you see Parkland to West Baton Rouge Parish Museum, you get in free to see the exhibit.
So Leo Honeycutt's at noon, starting speaking at the West Baton Rouge Museum across the river, and it'll be remembering President John F. Kennedy campaign journey. And Kennedy actually kicked off his campaign for the 1960 presidency in Louisiana. There's a great photo in yesterday's Advocate, 1959, in Crowley with Edwin Edwards, who at that time was not well known. And then at 3 o'clock and at 7 o'clock, the Manship Theater will present the film Parkland, recounting the chaotic events that occurred in Dallas on the day Kennedy was assassinated. And what an irony that 48 hours later, Lee Harvey Oswald is brought to the same hospital. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, I just want to make a point. I don't think it was possible for Lee Harvey Oswald with that rifle to go bang, bang, bang that rapid with a bolt-action rifle. Thanks.
What about the Mannlicher Carcano rifle?
Mannlicher Carcano.
Yes.
An Austrian and an Italian. The rifle was introduced in 1880 and then was used by Italy in World War II, and it worked. I myself don't know anything about shooting guns, not a requirement, but there's no question that rifle was perfectly capable from the sixth floor of firing shots. But as for those who know otherwise, then either turn off the radio or close your ears.
Mm-hmm. It was capable, but there may have been others firing away as well. And some say it might not have been Oswald firing the Mannlicher Carcano, but David Colbert believes Lee Harvey Oswald, the man from New Orleans, 24 years old, is the guy who did it. Thank you, David. Thank you, Renee. And remember, this Friday, Manship Theater and the West Baton Rouge Museum, lots going on. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And Boo Thomas is in the house for a few minutes to talk about the Smart Growth Summit. Good morning, Boo.
Good morning, Jim.
And how many years is this?
This is number 8.
Number 8. So yeah. We've been talking about smart growth for some time. Do we have smart growth going on in our community right now?
Well, we do. We have some great instances of good smart growth and some not so great.
But what are some of those that are not so great?
Oh, goodness. Well, of course, we haven't solved our traffic problem, and you don't see a lot of bike trails. Mm-hmm. That's changing. We also have trying to have a good transit system, and I don't know if you've noticed all these bus benches around that have just popped up. That's visual litter, I would say. Mm-hmm. That's not really smart. But what you will know is tonight, a free talk by Andres Duany, the author of our wonderful plan for downtown, which is a smart growth plan. Jim, we didn't even know the term smart growth when Duane came to town 15 years ago. And so he will talk about our progress at a free talk at 6 o'clock tonight. But he really will look at everything that has happened and what was predicted and what's good and what's bad. But the great thing is Victor Dover, who's with Dover Coal, mm-hmm. is one of the foremost experts internationally on bicycle trails, complete streets, on making streets really and for people in the neighborhoods. I'm not talking about seven-lane interstates or arterials. I'm talking about streets that are in neighborhoods and through that connect our neighborhoods.
Well, as far as the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, what has BRAF done as far as perpetuating and promoting smart growth in our community?
Wow. Look around everywhere. When the old Capitol Hilton was not being renovated, they stepped in and put an amazing layered financing deal together using all its partners. And now you have the Capitol Hilton, which is the one of the best Hilton flags in the nation. And so they looked at that. They have promoted the whole Shaw Center for the Arts, taking that wrecked old auto hotel, which people don't remember, mm-hmm. and putting together one of the most complicated deals to do the Shaw Center for the Arts.
Is the new Hilton downtown, is it a profitable venture?
Well, you know, the foundation was able to sell it to a different company, and it was very profitable before then, so yes. And then the Indigo Hotel has been profitable, right. And now we have the Hampton Suites. So all of that layered on to a plan that had a lot of projects, a lot of action items. And I think we counted up 90 of the 104 action items have been done in Plan Baton Rouge. But I don't want to leave without saying something about the IBM building that's coming downtown. When Colleen Arnold and Cameron Art, who will actually, Cameron will be on a panel on Tuesday at 1:15, they said one of the reasons that IBM decided to locate this special service center in Baton Rouge was because of the progress and the activity that they saw in downtown.
Well, the tax incentives certainly are a help as well, and there have been stories. The Business Report's done a good job of this. Some areas get tax incentives and others don't. How is that determined?
Well, now, you would be surprised, but I have no idea in terms okay. of anything financial.
All right. All right. Well, the new development on Perkins Road, where the old Walmart and Books a Million was, where Galatoire's is, there's a beautiful new shopping area there, and BRAF was involved intricately with that, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. And that was actually a vacant lot that could not be purchased, could not be acquired for anyone, and there were multiple owners, and BRAF really put its brain to work and its heart to work and made that whole deal happen. And so that actually followed a template that some planners came in and said, if you took that block and wanted it to be a smart growth development, this is what it would look like. Mm-hmm. It doesn't follow exactly because you have some public agencies and private developers that had to be satisfied also.
Well, in Stephanie's story in the Business Report, she noted how this one has gone well, but she said the one across the street, Acadian Thruway, the other shopping complex, is not as pristine and elaborate. Is there any reason for that?
I would say that shopping center does not adhere to smart growth principles, where when you drive by, all you see is a sea of parking, and that's something that we really do not promote, and it doesn't feel too walkable, whereas you might have buildings just as far apart at the new Acadian Perkins Village, but it feels very friendly and walkable and easy to get around in.
Now, that's done literally by design, but you say it doesn't feel too walkable. There's a parking lot there. You certainly walk through the parking lot, but architecture can make a big difference.
I think if you just stand back and look at those two developments, and just it's, of course, personal preference, but the buildings where Trader Joe's, Nadu, Petco, all of those are. Those invite you in. There is landscaping, there's sidewalks, there's good, safe lighting. And the other is just the typical old parking lot. There's no landscaping, and it's not. Now, you have great establishments that draw you, and you go there regardless, Jubin's and Tuesday Morning and, you know, the foyer. But I think if you would pull some buildings to the street, make it much more inviting, Perkins Row on Bluebonnet is a great example of a very walkable, inviting atmosphere, and it works.
I guess it's unfortunate for Perkins Row that that complex has been enveloped with so much controversy that it is unrelated to how it looks, how it feels.
And how it works.
And how it works.
Yeah.
So you don't think Perkins Row is going to shut down, do you?
Oh, no. No, it's got too many good things going for it. It'll weather that, I'm quite sure.
Well, tonight, Andres Duany, this guy's like the godfather of this kind of thing, isn't he? For those smart growth people like Boo, he's the bomb, isn't he?
He's the bomb. I mean, I think all of us who were there remember in 1998 when he was actually throwing bombs, lighting fires, and challenging everything we ever knew or thought or dreamed. And the man is still doing it today. I was thrilled that he agreed to come tonight. He will entertain. Don't feel like it's going to be a lecture. But right before that, you're going to hear Victor Dover talk about what this impending boom is going to mean for our communities across Louisiana, which is kind of scary. But also, Andres will very much entertain, but he is one of the most brilliant minds on architecture and planning and urban design.
So time and place?
Manship Theater, 6 o'clock, free to the public. It's 6 to 7, and then it'll follow with a delightful reception where you can challenge Andres and Victor Dover with everything that you have.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Boo Thomas, and good luck this week, and we will revisit the Smart Growth Summit this Wednesday. So thank you, Boo. Take care. We're joined now by David Ross Huddle, American writer, professor. His most recent book is Black Snake at the Family Reunion from LSU Press. His poems, essays, and short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, and in many other places. And he will be in our midst this week. Good morning, Professor
Huddle.
Good
morning, Jim. Good to speak with you, especially since you used my middle name. Most people don't know my middle name.
Well, David Ross is a good name, and you're arriving in Baton Rouge tomorrow. You'll read, I think, on the 20th, which was, according to my calendar, is this Wednesday. You're a guy in the literary circles who's kind of like Andres Duany in the smart growth circles. You're a well-known man.
I hope so. Well, I'm really excited to be coming to LSU, which I've known about for years, and, of course, anybody who keeps up with football knows a lot about LSU, but I'm particularly honored to be there because of the literary heritage at LSU. I've been known about the Southern Review and Robert Penn Warren and Alan Tate and those folks and the Fugitives, and I've been read their textbook in my freshman year in school, so the fact that I've never been there and I'm finally going to go to a place that is considered the real center of Southern literature, as far as I'm concerned, is very exciting to me.
Well, people who are in our community who haven't been here for a while may not realize that when you say that, I don't think you're exaggerating. Robert Penn Warren, the guy who gave us All the King's Men, he started the Southern Review and was recognized worldwide for his contributions to literature.
Absolutely. And really founded a whole school of thinking about literature that throughout universities and college all over the country have been studied and are still reckoning with that. The New Criticism, I think it was called. So it's really quite a place. And the Southern Review remains a very powerful literary journal in the country, and LSU Press keeps on publishing distinguished books. So it's a great place, at least as I see it from here in Vermont.
From Vermont. We're joining us from Burlington right now is David Ross Huddle. Tell us about Black Snake at the Family Reunion from LSU Press. What a title.
Well, I'm glad you asked about it. It comes from a photograph that was taken at a family reunion, and the Huddle family reunion many years ago, in when my daughter Bess came into possession of a black snake. Her cousins caught this black snake for her and gave it to her, and I think they expected, because she was a girl, she would be frightened of it. She was not at all. She loved having it. And so she had it in her hands, wrapped around her arm, and she took it in to show it to her mother, and just scared the daylights out of her mother, and her mother had to go up to her room. So I think my daughter learned something about black snakes and about power and family in that moment. And there's a picture of her holding the black snake with her little sister, just studying her, seeing, how does this work? You know, my sister's got a black snake, and she's enjoying. So I have a photograph of it, and that stayed with me for many years. So the first poem in the book is a poem about that photograph, and the book includes the photograph. And it goes on to have quite a number of pieces about family. And then I'll have to say it goes off into a bit of fiction writing, too. So I think it's a book that is considered extremely readable, and a book that you're likely to like if you like poetry, and likely to like if you don't like poetry. I will say that it has won two prizes. One was the award for poetry in New England in the 2013, the Penn New England Award for Poetry. It's also recently won the Appalachian Book of the Year Award for Poetry in 2013. I think there's no other book ever published that won both the Penn New England Award and the Appalachian Writers Award.
And it's from LSU Press.
That is from LSU Press.
David Ross Huddle started his career in fiction in 1975. His first work was published, Dream with No Stump Roots in It. Now, your background is somewhat different, I think, than contemporary writers. You served in Vietnam, and when I say you served, you served. How did that experience shape your thought process and your writing?
Well, I have to say that that my having been in the service pretty much straightened me out. I had been a very bad student and a self-indulgent young man, and so when I came back from the Army, I got serious about school. But when I came back, and I had wanted to be a writer, I think that was my excuse for doing badly in school. I thought, oh, well, I'll be a writer. You know, I don't have to fill out with this academic work. When I came back, I really wanted to be a writer. And it turned out that I had material to write about. Since I had been in Vietnam and was a fiction writer, I tried writing some stories about Vietnam. And as a result of that, I had two of those stories taken by literary journals, first by the Georgia Review in 1969, and then by Esquire in 1971. And both of those stories, I think, were taken because they were about Vietnam. If I hadn't had that material to write about, it would have taken me at least two or three more years to write a story good enough to be taken just on its literary merits. And I've only realized that here late in my life. So in my case, it was an experience that did me good.
Well, Professor Huddle teaches creative fiction, poetry, and autobiography at the University of Vermont, and is also a professor at Middlebury College. He was a military intelligence specialist in Vietnam. He will be in our midst this Wednesday and Thursday, and Professor Adelaide Russo is with us. Where can we see and hear this fine gentleman?
We're very honored that David Huddle is going to be the guest speaker for the yearly graduate student conference at LSU. On the 20th of November, there will be a benefit for the Comparative Literature Student Support Fund to allow students to go to present papers at conferences.
So where will this be?
This will be at the home of John Turner and Jerry Fisher. And if you'd like more information about the benefit, please call 578-4252, or you could send an email to complitlsu@lsu.edu, and that's complitlsu at lsu.edu.
If you didn't get all that, it's 578-4252, 225-578-4252. And then this Thursday, Professor Huddle will be involved with our poet laureate, Ava Heyman, and James Bennett. They're going to be at a roundtable, correct?
That's right. On Thursday, there will be a day-long conference devoted to the short story, one of the courses being offered in the comparative literature program this term, a course offered by Gerald Kennedy, is on the short story. And students will be speaking in Hill from 8 until...
That's Hill Memorial Library,
Hill,
right?
Memorial Library on the LSU campus. And the roundtable will be from 3 to 4:30.
3 to 3 o'clock on Thursday at Hill Memorial for Professor David Huddle. Professor, have a good trip. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. Great to talk with you.
And thank you, Professor Adelaide Russo. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.